fellow watch lovers, nerds, enthusiasts, or however you identify. You're listening to 40 and 20, the Watch Clicker podcast with your hosts, Andrew, and my good friend, Everett. Here, we talk about watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like. Everett, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm back in the state of Oregon, which is nice. I like home.
It's pretty okay here.
But I also really liked Utah. I was in Utah for 4 days, which is kind of a short trip.
Especially for a honeymoon. I don't know how you got all that in.
I went to Utah for 4 days to ski. Specifically went to the Alta ski resort. Not Alta, Alta.
Yeah, Alta's a beauty salon.
That's right. And it was really cool. If you've ever been there, you already know that place has a vibe. It's a vibe.
I've not been there, so please describe said vibe.
It's ski only, which means a couple things. One, it means the people there are kind of wealthy.
No young riffraff.
And they're old. So I would say the average age there is maybe 15 or 20 years older than any other ski resort I've ever been to, which is interesting. It didn't bother me any. You'd expect there to be some snootiness, but I didn't pick any of that up.
You don't have to be snooty when you've already excluded all the people that you would snoot at.
I think that's maybe exactly right, Andrew. The other really interesting, and then it's just snowing. It's a beautiful mountain. It's smaller than I expected it to be, but it's really well laid out. and it's just it's a great skiing mountain. The other thing that I found really interesting. So they've got five lodges. I of course only stayed at one, and all of them are on the resort. None of them are owned by the resort. They're all sort of independently owned, and they have drastically different feelings, apparently. I stayed at one called the Peruvian, which I think is known for being rustic, to use a nice word. I wouldn't say it was shabby, but maybe leaning towards that. It just had this like old world, knotty pine feeling. Like they're not dumping a bunch of money into finishes.
Like they're maybe 2 or 3 years away from closing down for 2 years for renovations.
Well, perhaps. Yeah, actually, I understand the owner's kind of old, and when he dies, his kids are probably going to sell it, and who knows what happens then. But it definitely had this rustic, shabby feel to it, but also like everything's super expensive. Right. Mm-hmm. So we were in there's three of us in a 2-bedroom suite with 4 single beds. And I think that it was like $1,600 a night.
Whew.
For the three of us, which is a lot of money, but that includes food. So the other sort of piece of this is it's like a European lodge experience where you're all eating together in a dining room for at least breakfast and dinner. We didn't really go back for lunch very often, but that was an option. But you have to take your ski boots off, so it's like meh. But when you go to breakfast, you make reservations for dinner. So
that's kind of nice.
We want to eat tonight at 6. We want to eat tonight at 7. And then when you get there, they sit you down at a big table, like a 10-person table, and you just talk with the people at the table, which was different than anything.
Are they paid companions, or are they people who are also staying there?
The latter.
Okay.
You may be able to arrange the former, though. I don't know. I didn't ask. And the dinner is like a 2 to 2.5 hour process. It's a 4-course meal.
Whew.
And the food was excellent. Excellent. The first night I was there, I was hungry and I took a flyer on a steak, and it was a ribeye, and it was phenomenal. Like a better steak than anything you could get at Outback.
I should hope so.
Wow. But Outback has some decent meat. It's not good, but I expected something of that level. No, this thing was fucking clutch. I was like, holy shit. So I guess for, $1,600 a night or whatever, they can throw a decent steak in there.
You'd hope.
Yeah. I mean, really, the experience was, despite being rustic and shabby, was really pretty posh. Mm-hmm. That's the word I was looking for.
Pomp and circumstance.
Yeah, posh. Very posh, despite being this rustic, shabby, sort of like anti-posh thing. It was actually really like upscale. Mm. Weird. Cool. I loved it. We've actually already made reservations to go back next year. But I think we're going to go to a different lodge just for variety. But yeah, I loved it. I was like, fuck, this is cool, man.
No communal dining.
Still communal dining. Yeah. Different place.
Interesting.
We actually have, so we couldn't get the same exact space at the one we stayed at. So we made reservations at another one, but we were kind of on a waiting list for the, yeah. Anyway, we'll see what happens. It all books out like a year ahead.
Crazy.
So if you want to go there in March, you've got to make your reservations in March.
And winter's going later, so.
It is. Well, it's Salt Lake, so March is sort of their big month anyway. Mm. Yeah, and the snow was great, dude.
It looked great.
It snowed on us pretty much the whole time. It was fantastic.
Nice.
Our very first time up the lift, we're sitting on a quad. It's the three of us who are traveling together, and this probably 65-year-old woman who was solo skiing on a Monday morning. Fucking A. You go, girl. And she was like, oh, are you guys from here? We're like, oh, no, we're from Oregon. She was like, oh, okay, well, sorry to say, the snow's not very good today. And we're looking around, and it's like, well, it looks pretty okay. And she's like, yeah, kind of icy out there. And I remember she said that, and I'm looking, and I see this guy ski by underneath us, and it's just whisper quiet. And I'm like, there's no ice out here. What is she talking about? And it's just because the snow there is so good in March that this was a bad day. Which,
meanwhile, it's like among the best days of snow you've ever experienced.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say that, but it was definitely like totally acceptable conditions anywhere else you are in the world, maybe besides there, the Wasatch Mountain. So, yeah, pretty terrific. You know, and they have like a 400-inch or a 500-inch base at any given time in March, and it's like, whatever.
Not much.
Yeah, that's right. It was great. Really good time. Andrew, how are you?
I am good. I'm in I just finished day one of a class today that it's hard to tell who the demographic audience is, which is really frustrating to me. It's a really diverse group of people, which is unlike, and I don't mean diverse like in, I mean in like profession diverse, which is a testament to how poorly targeted this course is for professional education.
Not diverse like after school television.
No, yeah, it's trying. So I'm a little bit grumpy because I have two more days of it. I have to drive an hour to get there, and then an hour home.
Where's it at?
Salem.
Yeah, boo.
Yeah, it's not great. So I'm a little grumpy from having that experience and looking down the barrel of two more days of it. Like it's such a broad group that they're presenting such broad information to that there's no way anyone can glean anything from it. But at the end of the 3 days, I will get a certificate from FEMA. So yes. That's what matters. Is that
you going to put that on the wall?
No, no, I'm not. I'm not, but it rounds out a big basic course list that I need to finish out. So, yeah, it's just irritating. It's just irritating.
That stuff's always irritating. Like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, but if you imagine if you're in like what's pitched as a CLE, a continuing legal education course, and you're also in it with like foresters from BLM.
I mean, I've done that. I mean, not literally foresters from BLM, but a similar circumstance.
But that's the diversity of population. And
I know the frustration.
Which means that the information is valuable to nobody.
Sure. Well, make of it what you can.
Well, yeah, I'm just heckling. I'm just like sitting. I'm using my like very insidest voice. So only the three people around me can hear as I'm like heckling under my breath.
Yeah, fair enough. Mm-hmm. You know what also is not after school television diverse. Alta.
Also, yeah.
In any event, we're not here to talk about skiing in Utah or about emergency management education.
FEMA.
We're here to talk about watches. And oh boy, we brought some watches to talk about. Well, we didn't physically bring watches.
Well, we're wearing watches.
Yeah, we are.
But not any of the watches that we're going to talk about. And I'm going to kick us off because this is a watch that I saw this article and I was like, what do you mean this doesn't already exist? And interestingly enough, that same thought was talked about in the article that I read. So Baltic Hermetic, two new colorways, the Glacier limited editions in black and white. And number one, I'm really shocked that these don't already exist in black and white, such that I went and looked and was like, oh, they do not in fact exist in black and white, which
it was one of our complaints about the Hermetic is that it was, there was no black or white.
Yeah. They've sort of lightly fixed that in the way of these limited editions of 100 each, 200 in each color, so 400 total in these black and white. And these are being called the Glacier limited editions because the dials are textured in a way that look like the face of a glacier. They're these really beautifully carved out and textured black and white dials, and they are gorgeous. They're the Hermetic, right? They're, 38 millimeter cases, 37 millimeter case, 47 lug, 46 lug to lug, 10/8 thick, Miura 9039 movements, 150 meters of water resistance. They do come in two shoe options. Number one being an FKM color matched to the dial, or a beads of rice or flat link bracelet. 600 euros on the rubber, 665 on the bracelet. I think these look fire on both bracelet options. I'm partial to the beads of rice, I think, but that black on the flat link is also really good. So I don't know which I prefer. I do prefer both of them on the bracelet to the color matched FKM. I don't particularly dig white rubber straps.
I think they're fun, but yeah.
They're fun, but I think they're pretty singularly functional, right? It's just to be a fun watch. Black FKM works on virtually everything.
Yeah.
But color matched white, I see why people won't do it. I can get with it. This dial texture is phenomenal.
It is. It's a really neat dial texture. I actually am not crazy about textured dials, but for whatever reason, this one feels better to me than a lot of these.
I think it's because it's, even though it's not subtle, it's very much a dial texture in the way, and this is not Grand Seiko dial texture, but very much in the same way that Grand Seiko applies dial texture, and that it's really deliberate, it's really visible, but it's not the focus of the watch. It just is also on the dial. And I think a lot of dial texture becomes the focal point of the dial. And that's not this.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. What's the name of that company? Is it Stella? Stella that does really heavily textured. They do like linen dials.
Everyone, there's tons of brands that do.
I am not a huge fan of that level of texture. And when I first saw these, I saw these this week. And then, of course, you sent this link. And I was like, meh. And then the more I looked at it, I was like, you know, this doesn't bother me. I think the Hermetic is such a great watch for $600 or $650, or whatever mm-hmm. these things wind up being. I mean, on paper, so it's 10.8, including a box crystal, 37 millimeters, 46 millimeter lug to lug, 150 meters of water resistance. I mean, this is like this is a banger.
Mm-hmm.
This is an absolute banger of a watch at an incredible price. 9039 movement, which I'm a huge fan of.
It's the standard. Like you're going to pay about this price for anything rocking a 9039. Like this is exactly the price point that this watch needs to be at. And I think you're getting more bang for your buck in the way of finishing. You're getting more bang for your buck in the way of
tons of great loom, by the way.
Oh yeah. Tons of loom. I mean, like the loom shots make it look like a fully loomed dial.
I think it's an absolute banger. I think it's a shame that they don't have a black version in their standard lineup. So I think it's a mistake to have only a limited edition black dial in the Hermitique.
This could be the precursor to releasing black and white catalog editions.
I don't need white, but give me black. I need a black dial on this.
I like white dials. I have a couple. But I want that crisp Christopher Ward white. This is a little bit off white. This is like a Sarby.
150 meters of water resistance. Dude, this thing is so great.
11 points. This is a great, great everyday watch too.
Great watch.
Mm-hmm.
Great watch. I'm going to talk about another great watch.
The Baltic Hermetique.
And this is a watch that surprised me. So this actually came out about 5 or 6 weeks ago. So it's older than our new release. But this is a brand that doesn't oftentimes make like the circuit. And I think that is because Cameron Weiss does not market his watches the same way a lot of folks do. He's making incredibly small scale watches, making them largely in-house, meticulously crafted watches. We've talked about Weiss before on this show.
It's been a while because it's been a while since we've seen a release from him.
I think he releases more watches than you know, but they're just small scale. He's not doing a lot of watches. He's making a small amount of watches. Anyway, Weiss is not my thing. It's not my thing. They're always a little bit awkward. They've got like some of their vibe is a little bit stodgy, I would say. I think that's the word I would like to use.
Interesting. That's not the word I would choose, but I see why you use it.
It's just there's not been a lot of these watches that interested me. And this watch also does not fit into what I like. So what this is a limited edition, meaning I think there's only 20 of these. They're being handcrafted. A limited edition titanium black DLC 38 millimeter standard issue field watch. So his standard issue field watch is a watch that's in his regular catalog. This is a Tennessee tangerined dial with a black titanium DLC case. And I saw this thing and I was like, wait, what? I don't know what it is about this. I think that the dial color is really captivating.
It's a really, really good orange, like richer than Doxa orange.
It feels to me a little bit like Foster orange. It's got that slightly sheeny. I mean, it is just a terrific orange. And this watch is in 38 millimeters. So they also make this in a 42, which is way too big.
Big difference between the 38 and the 42 is that the 38 has a 6 o'clock small seconds, yes, and the 42 has a 9 o'clock small seconds, which is as offensive to me as a 42 millimeter watch. It's like, hey, you can have this weird thing or you can have this pretty great thing. The small seconds are a bit of a miss for me.
Yeah, that's right. It's got a 7001 base movement, which I think Cameron Weiss fully assembles and finishes by hand, and his case finishing is particularly good. It's a manually wound 21,600 beat movement, 42-hour power reserve, blah, 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 blah. It's got a grade 5 titanium, so they are actually 6AI-4V grade 5 titanium, 38 millimeters of diameter, 46.2 lug to lug, 9.2 thick, including the crystal.
That's razor thin.
Sapphire case back.
Because box crystal, right? Yeah, domed at 9.8. Ooh.
100 meters of water resistance. Black oxide steel with hand-painted Luminova. I mean, this is a really, really elegant watch, and it's incredible. It's meticulously put together. You know, I've never handled a Weiss watch, but there's nobody saying, oh, these are overpriced or whatever, because the people that have them are like, yeah, this watch is the shit.
The amount of hours of labor that go into this are why it's a $2,500 watch.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah, did we say that? 2,500
$2,500 bucks on the 38. I think it's the same on the 42.
Yep.
That's probably where he's making his money back, because hand painting a 38 millimeter dial is tedious, I imagine.
Hand painted dials.
These are gorgeous. The orange is perfect, contrasted against this black DLC. We need to find a metallurgist and just do a anatomy of metal episode. Because neither of us know shit about buck. I don't know. 316L steel. That's what everyone uses. Or grades 1 through 5 titanium. So when I hear 6A1-4V grade 5 titanium, well, I have a response, because I don't know what's happening. I don't know what that means. So if any of you are metallurgists or sorcerers of that ilk, we'd be super happy to have you on and talk about it. This is a baller watch. And I'm with you in the way of a lot of Weiss don't scratch the itch for me. The 42 really doesn't scratch the itch. In fact, it's kind of like when you scratch a mosquito bite and it sort of makes it a little bit worse.
Right.
This 38, even with the small seconds, I'm like, ooh, I could see that.
Yeah, I'm with it.
I could do with a titanium bracelet instead of this kind of cross-hatched.
Yeah, I think it's an FKM.
FKM.
Basket.
But this is hot.
Andrew, what's next?
Next up for me. Ooh. I have another textured dial today. This is weird for me, because you also know that this is not my flavor. The Christopher Ward Oracle Time C65 Dune Shoreline. And, you know, for a long time, the C65 to me was kind of like, watch. And in the last year, the C65 from Christopher Ward has been like siren calling me from the depths. It's a great watch, right? It's well sized. These come in at 38, 43.7 lug to lug, 11.9 thick. It's just an appropriately sized watch. But they're, you know, kind of against the rest of the Christopher Ward lineup, just not really my jam. But as of late, these have been scratching the itch. So this Oracle Time is the aptly released collaboration with Christopher Ward, kind of in conjunction with the British Watchmaker event that happened yesterday.
Yeah, recently.
Recently, in the last couple days. And it is gorgeous. This is I have to find the material. It's a matte gray brass ripple dial with applied indices, Super Luminova, SW200, COSC certified, 28.8.
Elaborate grade.
All of it, right? This is a specced out watch that it's called the Dune Shoreline, because it looks just like the ripples that you find in the sand on a receding tide, and it is gorgeous. This is what the Seamaster waves should look like, as opposed to just cuts in the dial. Just these really gentle waves across the dial. This is gorgeous.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I really like this. Another heavily textured dial that I am not at all opposed to. I guess they're making this texture with the hydraulic press, actually pushing the brass.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
So they're doing it. These are real ripples. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
These are coming in at a little north of what you're typically paying for it. These are $1,260 on a bracelet, $1,175 on the... Oh, so $1,260 bracelet strap combo, $1,175 with just the bracelet, and $1,020 with just the leather strap. Get this new iteration of the Christopher Ward bracelet is, by all accounts, fixing all of the misses with the previous iteration of bracelets.
It does have a mail-in link, which I'm not a huge fan of, but yeah, beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah, I'm okay with it. It curves that watch better. It gives a just more reach around on that watch, and it just sucks it into your wrist. And this is gorgeous. The loom contrast against this gray dial, like this is the gray that I want. And that light catcher case, like you really think you're looking at sand. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great watch. I think that's fun. I'm going to talk about Citizen.
Oh, interesting.
Citizen has been doing things. So Citizen is a company that I think is increasingly vertically aligned, meaning, you know, with their acquisition of Bulova and their acquisition of Le Jupere, their capabilities in-house, their in-house capability. I mean, they can do everything, right? Citizen can do everything. They can grow crystal, you know, they can grow their own sapphire. They can do all of it, probably most of it. I'm not sure they can actually do all of it yet.
I wonder what they're not doing, though, because of the financial ass they have working.
You know, maybe hairsprings. I'm not sure. And maybe they're doing hairsprings. Shit, I don't know. If you know, let us know. But Citizen is an increasingly vertically aligned company. And I think, but for maybe one or two other companies I can think of, maybe Rolex being one, Citizen's got just a ton of ass right now. And they're doing good stuff with it, right? Between their really sort of like tech forward Japan JDM stuff. And you know, the Suyosa that came out this year, they're just doing a lot. So they've released a new Series 8. So Series 8 is their kind of like luxury models in between their like approaching haute stuff and their like lower end Suyosa or whatever. They released this week the Citizen 890 mechanical models. I believe this is a so it's not the caliber 210. Rather, I believe these come with a 9015, but it's a full-on integrated sports watch that's, I think, competing with things that are significantly higher. Now, this has got a very, very definite Royal Oak vibe to it. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the big octagonal bezel that sort of pseudo sits bezel, high.
Yeah.
You've got the case that, the mid case that, if you didn't know better, you might, is that multiple parts?
They do, like, they cut out underneath that bezel separation to create a shadow.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like it could be a multi-part mid case. I don't believe it is. I think it's just one part with you know, cuts and shaping. 9051 movement, which is, again, a great movement. They've got this thing specced at like 10 to 20 per day, which is fine. I think these things are just like sort of building out their like cool watch catalog, and I'm having a hard time being upset about anything with this watch. The only thing I'm maybe not crazy about with these watches, so they're coming in at like $1,600, depending on what you get, which is a lot of money. It's 40 and a half millimeters, which is fine. 11.7 thick, which for this watch, I'd really like them to get that down. But we've got 200 meters of water resistance on this, so I'm sure that that creates some thickness.
They're also trading some of that thickness for depth in the dial because they have this huge, like really gradually sloped chapter ring to create some depth into that dial and almost achieve the light catcher thing. And I think they could stand to lose some of that, but you'd also lose some of the legibility that is kind of achieved by that reflection off of that chapter ring.
Well, I think that gets me to the one part of this that I'm not actually pumped about, which is the dials on these. They're doing a lot with these dials. So they've got this sort of like grid pattern, and they've also got like a limited edition copper dialed version, which has like this geometric mosaic thing. I think they're doing too much with the dials here.
But that's Citizen.
Yeah.
They're doing the Citizen thing.
It maybe is par for the course with Citizen. I would like these a lot better if they had a more simple dial. The handset, I'm not wild about.
Again, the Citizen things. Those are Citizen hands.
The markers are fine. I don't mind the markers. The chapter rings or the rehouts, not crazy about. So I don't know. I'm torn on this. I want to say that this is a really, really neat entry into the Citizen lineup, but
this is iterative growth. That's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing iterative growth toward this really cool shit, and they're seeing who they can drag with them.
Yeah, maybe.
Or bring along.
I'm not exactly sure I know what you mean with that, but I do see this as a positive step, but there's enough here that I'm like, did you ask anybody what they thought about this? Because it seems like you created this for someone who doesn't exist.
They're grabbing people who are going to the Macy's counter who want a Royal Oak.
Nobody's going to the Macy's counter to buy a $1,600 automatic.
I don't know. I
Miyota.
They're grabbing that demographic of people who don't know any better, have some money to spend, and see that and recognize the Royal Oak cues. They recognize the fashion brand cues. They're trying to capture a market. And when you say that person doesn't exist, that person does exist.
I don't know that I agree with you on this.
Just not yet in the watch world. That's who they're trying to grab. Somebody who doesn't know what they don't know and recognizes some really familiar cues, and their friends and them have been wearing fashion brands, but they're like, oh, well, Citizen, I'm going to get something a little different.
You might be right. I think the person that you're describing isn't buying a Citizen watch because they consider Citizen to be a $250 Eco Drive.
Maybe. Yeah.
But I could be wrong. I mean, obviously, I don't know. Somebody's buying this.
It's not me. They're not marketing this to us.
Yeah. It feels really close to me. And ultimately, with the chapter, that like really sort of big, clunky chapter ring and the dial textures, it's a miss for me.
They're trying to grab people who can't buy Panerai yet.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
I mean,
It's a cool watch.
It's sign of really good things to come.
Perhaps.
Which is what we're seeing from Citizen, right? We're seeing this incremental growth and development and improvement and far less like weird misses like we see with Bulova. It's like, why would you do 98% of the things right and then leave the dick on the dial?
Yeah, some major problem. Yeah, I don't think this is a major problem. I think there's subjective decisions that I don't like. But it's interesting. It's interesting. What's next?
Ooh, next up, I'll talk about our homies. from Intersect.
Oh.
Of Intersect. Hosting Intersect? Presenting Intersect? I'm not sure. A new watch show hits Atlanta for the first time. Intersect Atlanta is going to bring 15 independent brands together for a one-day show. If you're not in Atlanta, it's going to be a little late for you because it happens this Saturday.
Yeah, you're going to have to rush over there.
So if you're near-ish to Atlanta, Intersect, as presented by our friends from Notice and their partners in this endeavor, are going to be coalescing in Atlanta this Saturday. And that's exciting. Intersect is a show that you went to in LA, right?
Yep, as a presenter
this, even. This last year in the fall?
2022, yep.
So that was a year and a half ago, huh?
Yeah. I can't remember.
I thought you went last year.
It may have been early 2023 that I went. Yeah,
I think so. So this is it. It's happening. Intersect is a watch show, and it's designed like very much kind of the way that Windup began in hosting and lifting up emerging brands, new brands, young brands who can't afford to get into big watch shows, but are doing really cool, meaningful, awesome watch shit, is where Intersect is, as I see it. And that might be a little bit reductive of what's happening there, but I really see and think of Intersect as filling the vacuum that was left by Windup when Windup got big enough that brands couldn't afford to be there anymore. And it's an industry collection of brands who are just love and want to share watches.
Yeah, I really love the idea of Intersect. I'm not convinced totally that it's doing what you're describing. I mean, the presenters at Intersect, as far as I know, we got Notice, Formex, Jack Mason, Anardang, Christopher Ward, Fears, it's Laurier, Raven, a few other brands. So we know these guys really well. I know Wes and Colin really well. I know Steve Laughlin from Raven really well. Wow, I know him relatively well. I know these people. I think maybe a little bit different than what you're saying. I think these are people that really like each other. Mm. And have a shared vision on what the community should be. I'm not totally convinced that they're doing the yeoman's work on propping up the smaller brands of society. I don't think the show's really got the legs for that yet. Although I do see a future in which that could exist pretty easily. And if anybody's going to do it, I think it's these guys that are going to do it.
If we're being fair, Foster was there.
Yeah, at a very early, right. At a much different iteration of this event.
Right. I think it's true. So we're seeing some growth and some change and some evolution. But I think the vision is very much industry prop up and support.
I think that is the platonic ideal for what these guys want to do, and I'd love to see that happen. I'm not sure that's actually what's happening, but. You know,
and everyone just wants to get together in Atlanta.
These people want to hang out. They're like, I love these people, and we want to do something that's different than the other options, mm-hmm. which is not to disparage anybody, but the other options have gotten weird. And so let's do this the way we want to do it, which
district
is cool.
District time? Come on.
Well, I actually
think... I really want to go to a district time. I think maybe next year is a year.
I think district time is the closest thing... to what you're actually talking about. And for whatever...
Oh, I know. I just like to take jabs at Mike every episode. I usually have one planned out.
For whatever reason, district time doesn't have the same level of sexiness. And
it's because of Mike.
Could be because of Mike. It could be because of marketing. I'm not exactly certain.
It's because it's a grassroots... It's totally comfortable with where it's at. And I think that's great. There's no aspiration of making district time a national representation. They're not going to take that show on the road. And I think that's great.
Yeah. If you are in Atlanta, Saturday the 23rd, go to Intersect.
Yeah, of 2024. So if you're listening to this years from now,
yes,
don't Saturday, go to Atlanta.
March 23rd, 2024. You'll be able to see, for instance, the Pen Addict collaboration that we talked about on the show last week and
leaked a little bit,
which we also published an article on the website this week written by.
Ooh, are they going to have the what should be the next watch we talk about?
They will. So they are going to also have a copy, or at least a copy of the Notice Raven Trail Trekker. So this is a watch that, if you've been paying any attention to the Notice Design Lab webpage over the course of the last 9 months, you've seen a grayed out entry, Notice times Raven. I think they've even had the name up there for a while. This watch was leaked to us a few weeks ago.
I'm always really careful about the watches we talk about, like when we in our internal chats, because I'm never sure what's embargoed or not. Until I see an article that somebody else has published, I don't say a fucking word.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so we've known about this watch. Well, I've known about this watch now for several months. I saw pictures of it, like early pictures of it a while back, and have finally now seen what you've seen, because this watch has been fully announced. This is a full collaboration between two really, really cool brands in this space, Notice and Raven. And the design language of both of these brands is super apparent.
Yes. If you were to see this watch without seeing any logos on it, you'd be like, well, that looks like a Notice, but it also looks like a Raven. Who made this?
Yeah.
And the answer is both. They made it.
Yeah, both. You've got a really Raven dial. You've got a case that's Notice, but not like anything you've ever seen. I think that this is the same. I understand that this is the same mid case as the one that Notice is going to use for their upcoming Contrail 3.
Mm.
So I think that this is a sign of things to come. This thing has some stuff going on, though. So, one, you get this like super highly legible Raven dial and this handset that I would say is pretty distinctly Raven. You get a bezel that sort of feels to me like more Raven than Notice. In these big sort of blocky, highly legible numerals on the 24-hour track. 9075 GMT, so a collar GMT. And then you've got a Cerakoted gray, green, drab bezel on top of a gray DLC stainless steel case, which sort of trends. I think it looks like a titanium case, but it's not. It's a gray DLC steel case.
Which is like kind of the worst of both worlds.
I don't right?
It looks better than titanium, but it doesn't have the advantages of titanium.
Yeah, perhaps.
It's going to age really beautifully in a way that titanium doesn't.
It's going to age really cool. I don't know exactly how I feel. This watch is tacticool, right?
It's as tacticool as it gets.
And I think that's what you'd expect from this collaboration. In particular, that's what you'd expect with Raven. That's kind of Raven's jam.
But this is the most tacticool Raven has gone, right? Yeah. With Cerakote. Like, Cerakote exists in guns and knives.
Yeah, that's right.
Now watches.
And now watches, yeah. I think it's terrific. I think it's terrific. I don't know who it's for. Well, that's not true. I do know
for me, man, this is fucking, this is for me.
Nodex clasp on the bracelet. Nodex, in my experience, hit or miss. I love the idea of it. I've also have personal experience that it can be a bit hit or miss with the opening, you know, unintended opening. It's hard for me to be mad at this watch, though. It's really just lovely. I don't like the font on the bezel. It seems a little bit blobby to me.
$875.
I wish it was sharper, but yeah, at the price for a Collar GMT
with Cerakote, that's. I mean, I agree that the font is a little bit blobby. And I think the font is a little bit blobby as a function of the Cerakoting because it's such a kind of new application. I don't know that Cerakote has ever been applied in this type of detail. In what certainly hasn't been applied in this type of detail in this application, right? You know, Cerakote gets put on gun slides. Mm-hmm. With super fine cuts and lines, not in the same way as on a watch bezel.
It'll be interesting to see how these wear because Cerakote is...
can chip.
Beautiful and durable, but it's chippy, right?
Yeah, it can get chippy.
And so it'll be interesting to see how this wears. This has got a really fun case back. So Trail Trekker is actually a reference to the Oregon Trail. So... Kansas, really noted as being the gate to the Oregon Trail, with Oregon
St. Louis
being the end point. Yeah, that's right.
Wasn't St. Louis, that's in Missouri.
I actually think Kansas City, but I could be wrong.
I thought wasn't the arch in St. Louis the gateway?
Maybe. I don't know. Shit. I only know that they finish in Oregon City. I've been to the place.
Is the gate in Kansas City?
And so this has a Conestoga wagon on the back, which is a fun detail. Here's where things get interesting. This is a 200 meter Collar GMT. That is 11.8 thick from tip to tail with a terrific 46.6 lug to lug. This is, I think, the thinnest 200 meter Collar GMT that you can buy, and you can do it for under $200. Under $1,000.
Okay.
Well, under $1,000. Sorry.
If anybody's selling one for $200, sold, dibs.
So the spec on this alone makes it interesting. And then to the extent that the aesthetic and the style is what you want, geez Louise.
And so I'm going to credit this, James Stacy article real briefly, and we'll link it to, he says, also, let's not forget that Notice offers double the water resistance of the Rolex and matches that of the Tudor while being nearly 3 millimeters thinner for $875. And I think that really captures what Raven and Notice are doing in the way of pushing the edges of technological capabilities in their watches, and they're not being greedy about it. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're still giving the people what they want in a watch that we can all afford. And you know, maybe that's a bit privileged of me to say that everyone can afford an $875 watch, and you know, that is privileged of me. The fact is that for under $1,000, you can get into a professionally spec'd, better spec'd than a lot of these iconic watches that exist in the world, made by cooler people, people who we know. I think that's awesome. I love what they're doing. Yeah, this design lab project arm of Notice is fucking phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm not jumping up and down about some of the visual cues here, but in terms of the spec, it really becomes a compelling watch. And actually, I like the visual aesthetic cues. I just think it sort of is a pretty it's a niche.
This isn't for you.
I mean, it might be for me, actually. I don't know. I just don't think it's for everyone.
It's certainly not for everyone. This is a watch for me.
Andrew, what's next?
I forgot that we were talking about a watch that you picked. sort of.
Because you picked it.
Because, yeah, we picked it. I have an interesting... So I've been talking, over the last 3 months, have talked about multiple legal battles in the watch world, or things that have been going on. So a thing happened this last week that can kind of, it's on par with what we've seen of courts supporting modding and supporting, no, you can change things. So a Swiss high court ruled on a lawsuit between Rolex and the customizer Artisan de Genevieve. Maybe Artisan de Genève. I don't know. I'm not fancy. So Artisan de Genève is known for their modifications of Rolex and other watches, but Rolex being kind of the primary market segment there. A lawsuit began in 2020 when Rolex clandestinely purchased a Daytona from the website that had been customized. And they were like, hey, dudes, gotcha. Immediately, Artisan de Genève stopped selling watches from their website that belonged to them and transitioned their business model to primarily modding, doing high-level customizations, total reconstructions of these watches. There's a few really cool examples. There's a Spike Lee example of the Cool Hand Brooklyn Daytona, which is it's about the coolest Daytona I've ever seen, up to and including the rainbow. The lawsuit persisted because Rolex didn't want them altering their merchandise, right? You know, there's some IP interaction there. There's some warranty interaction there. There's a lot of components of this, of you send your personal watch to a company and then they do with it what you want. And we've seen this, Vortec. Yeah, we saw it with Vortec. We've seen this kind of before, and the courts have supported the alteration organization of saying, no, you can do what you want with your property. And we see this in this Swiss ruling that, yes, Artisan de Genève can still alter your stuff. It's your stuff. They did push back down their ability to like reapply Rolex logoing and stuff to your stuff that you've altered because it's no longer exactly theirs. So there's like some kind of interesting IP. But what's interesting is we've kind of seen that over the last couple years, the monopoly power of these brands start to be degraded in a really meaningful way. You know, we see the intervention of the French government saying, no, online retailers can sell your shit because you sold it to them, and then they can sell it. That's sort of how markets work. And we've seen with Vordic, no, you can have something made for your shit. And now in Switzerland, no, you can do whatever you want to your stuff. Now, they can't sell you, they can't buy it from a manufacturer, modify it, and then sell it under that same name. And this is interesting. And I'm wondering, with these rulings, like I'm just kind of seeing this monopoly of power of the big five kind of slowly like degraded. And I'm kind of excited for the reality that they're facing, that they're gonna have to make some changes.
Rolex?
These brands who have kind of hung their hat and just keep doing what they're doing.
You know, so this is actually a pretty heavily nuanced...
There's a lot to it, yeah.
Yeah, and so if you don't mind me being a lawyer for just
please
a
do.
Second. Yeah.
That's why I'm talking about it with a lawyer.
So the first issue, and you correctly identified it, is that ADG was at some point modifying watches on their own and then marketing those for sale. And when we talk about modifying,
gotcha.
there's a specific type of modification that they were doing that tends to be problematic, which is that they were altering the dials and sometimes the cases, but they were altering the Rolex branding. And so when they were marketing those things, you know, maybe there's a modified Rolex crown at 12 o'clock, or they've changed the text on the Daytona or the Rolex logo in a way that could potentially mislead a consumer that ADG is doing Rolex. They're mm-hmm. being Rolex. They have an agency perhaps from Rolex to do these things. That is a problematic behavior. And based on those early cease and desists, ADG stopped that.
Really quick too, because they knew. They knew they were pushing the envelope and they're like, yep, no, you're right.
I'm sure they have very expensive lawyers who told them that almost immediately. The other piece of this, which is taking Adam Levine or Spike Lee's watch and doing whatever. So there's this idea of like brand exhaustion. Like you can't maintain your brand forever. Once I sell you mm-hmm. that brand, it's yours to do with what you like. And really, that's what the courts said. These people can do this, and they can even advertise these services. ADG still has to be careful about what they do with the brands as they advertise. So they
have like a wall to enter their website.
That's right. So you can't, they can't like take out an advertisement in a magazine where they have a picture of a watch and say, hey, this is for sale if you want to come to our website. But if you, Andrew, want to buy a Datejust and take it to ADG, Rolex cannot stop your ability from modifying that, and nor can it stop ADG's ability for on your behalf modifying that. So there's this really sort of nuanced, it's all about the use of the branding, and that's okay in the context of you doing what you want with your own property, the property you've purchased. Rolex has sold you their brand. They've sold you that logo, that crown, that writing, whatever mm-hmm. it is. You have the right to do whatever the fuck you want.
To that one and that one only.
That's right. That's right.
What concerned me was the brand that I talked about 2 weeks ago in selling DLC to Explorers.
Yeah.
Because it would bug me to buy a watch and then have to send it out to get a DLC.
And I think that might be a little different.
It's super different, but it falls kind of in the same space of them selling Rolex that they've modified that isn't provided already by Rolex.
And that's where the idea of modifying the actual logos comes into play. And so there's some hair splitting there, mm-hmm. but there's some differences as well, right? Companies have been adding diamonds to Rolexes for ages. And everybody kind of agrees that that's fair play. But there's, you know, oftentimes these companies are jewelers and they're doing these custom, or to the extent they're doing them generally, they're not really advertising them. So there's some nuance here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. And we've seen a lot of really meaningful legal battles occurring in Europe about the Rolex supremacy. It's interesting to me.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. I don't
know that anything happens.
But I don't think this is a monumental change, but it does clarify the rights of the parties, all of the parties.
And I think it was a blow to Rolex.
Yeah.
Maybe. Which we've been seeing.
Maybe not. You know, I think this is one of those. We talked about this. We had Tony Traina on the show what seems like 100 years ago. Now Tony obviously is a big shot over at Hodinkee.
And we just still suck.
Is this a Tony article that you sent, actually? This seems like it may be.
Yeah, it sure is.
So you know, Tony's an educated attorney. I don't gather that he's practicing at this point, but you know, so he's really familiar with these ideas. And we had him on the show to talk about the Vorta case. And you know, one of the things that frequently comes up in these types of disputes is, on one hand, the company oftentimes looks like the big bad, you know, the big bad monolith pushing its weight around. But in some ways, a company like Rolex is obligated to protect their branding. And so sometimes you see these instances where, and we talked about this, where it felt like with the Vortex stuff, Hamilton was kind of pushing its weight. But oftentimes there's an impetus for a company to say, well, if we don't protect our brand in this way, if we don't fight with these guys, there could be unintended consequences about what our implicit or even explicit license in this case would mean for other people. So an implicit license is dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. Because it can lead to what we call legal waiver in the future. Well, you let Vortic do this forever and you knew they were doing this. And so you're going to now say that I can't do this similar thing. It's like, well, that's different, but it doesn't matter. You knew they were doing this and that didn't bother you.
Because they weren't a threat.
You've lost your right to complain about this. And so I think this is one of those types of cases where Rolex is like, gosh, we gotta try to fight them here. And we've got to clarify what the rights of the parties are. And by way of objecting to this and getting a really sort of tailored decision from the Swiss court, we can, in the future, use that decision, for better or worse, to fight off other people who might say there's waiver. We clearly haven't waived. We've defended ourselves to the maximum ability. And we've got this really specific ruling that can be differentiated from other activities in the future. Mm-hmm. So to anybody who's at home is like, oh, Rolex is a bully, there's some really practical, sound business decision-making that goes into these decisions a lot of times. And I remember feeling like I can see why Hamilton is doing what they're doing here. Although in that case, I do remember feeling like, they're kind of picking on Vortic. But there's good reasons for these a lot of times.
They wanted to prevent other people from doing it. I think they were probably okay with Vortic. 10 Vortics, that could be problematic.
Or companies that do what Vortic is doing, but maybe just a little differently, right? In a way that's more offensive.
They wanted it defined to Vortic.
I think that's right.
And I think ADG is a good example of like, no, we're maybe not so okay with this. Like, don't sell us our watch that you've altered. Be a little bit more discreet here.
And you know, there's a really obvious workaround to this, and this is what often happens in these cases, these sort of borderline cases, where you know, perhaps Hamilton, in a different world, Hamilton comes to Vortic and says, hey, this thing you're doing violates these legal principles. And Vortex says, no, it doesn't. And they're like, well, we think it does, but we don't want to fight with you. So what we want to do is offer you this settlement agreement that will include a license to use our product. You'll pay us a de minimis or nominal fee for that privilege.
Once.
And we'll grant you this perpetual or this, you know, 99-year license to do the thing you're doing, given these parameters, you know, given these rules. And then when the next company comes and tries it, and at that point, Hamilton could say, no, you can't do that. And say, well, Vortec does it. And I was like, well, we have an agreement with Vortec. They paid us.
They're licensed.
They're licensed. And so, you know, that's the workaround. And a lot of times that happens. I think that was really what was notable about Hamilton Vortec is that, as far as I know, and we've talked to RT about this, and he's never given me real specifics, but as far as I know, Hamilton never came to the table with that type of proposal. So
yeah, they were being bullies.
It did. I think so. Andrew, I've got one more watch I want to talk about.
Let's do it.
Ridiculous.
Okay.
It's ridiculous. Gerard Perregaux Laureato is one of the earliest of the integrated steel sport watches. I think it came a little bit after the Royal Oak, but before the Nautilus, before the 222. It is one of the players in this world, although maybe the least sort of highly regarded.
Yeah.
Anyway, Gerard Perregaux has introduced a Laureato chronograph, which is the same as the one that already exists, except that it's made from titanium. So grade 5 titanium Laureato chronograph.
Means something.
It means it's light. So it's a big watch. So the Laureato chronograph is a 42 millimeter watch that's 12 millimeters thick, made of steel. It weighs a ton, especially for a watch like this, which is sport, supposed to be kind of a svelte sport chronograph. Heavy. So this is, they're calling this the Laureato Chrono Tie 49, which I think refers to, this is the 40th anniversary of the Laureato. It's a $20,000 watch, you guys. Okay. I think the standard Laureato Chrono is 18.6, so just a small premium over...
It's titanium.
But it's titanium.
These pushers are just fucking phenomenal.
You know, we've seen a number... Yeah, they're really good. It's actually a screw-down chronograph. Great crown on this thing. I mean, this is a superb watch. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. It's got this, what do they call these? This dial texture. It's like Clou de Paris, I think, which is like, I think, Paris nails.
Fancy.
I mean, this is just the watch exudes fancy, right? But it's obviously ridiculous. The trend I kind of wanted to call out here is that I think that this gray on gray monotone titanium thing is the thing right now. This is the thing.
This is my flavor.
This is the thing. I love this watch. I'm never going to buy a $19,000.
And I'll never even touch
Laureato. But geez Louise. It's got a great movement. It's a module. It's a module on top of base chronograph, but it's beautiful. This is caliber GP03300, whatever the fuck that means. It's a 28.8 chronograph movement. I don't know anything about it,
but only 46 hours of power reserve, which is just,
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's a gorgeous automatic chronograph. I will say the date window on this, a little weird. I don't love it.
It's almost an afterthought.
Great snail subdials, great handset, great everything. I mean, we don't need to talk about
everything's good.
It's whatever. It's a Gerard Perregaux. It's fantastic.
Everything's good.
But really, really, really lovely and terrific watch. And I bet it wears a dream.
Yeah, that bracelet looks phenomenal. And you know it's going to be. Only 100 meters of water resistance. They're giving up a point there.
It's a BFW, a.k.a. Big Fucking Watch, which this should be. If I buy this watch, I want it to be a BFW.
It needs to be. And the thickness on it is probably just right, even for only 100 meters of water resistance. It's got perfectly proportioned crown guards.
Kind of a long lug to lug, I think. I think the lug to lug on this is like 52, but it curves down in a way that I think you won't even notice it.
No. And honestly, you want to notice this.
This is another Tony Traina article. We're giving Tony some love tonight.
Yeah, Tony's hitting it. He could hit this.
What, the watch or you?
I mean, take your pick.
All right, fair enough.
If he brings the watch, he can do whatever he wants. Yeah, it's lovely.
All right, that's the last thing I wanted to talk about, Andrew. You got anything you're dying to get on the air?
Nah.
Well, in that case, other things, what do you got?
We talked about Masters of the Air. Was it last week?
We did. I think
it was 2 weeks ago because we did a can episode for last week. So it's been 2 weeks since we talked.
I think it was 3 weeks ago that we talked about it. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
We talked about it recently.
And I do believe I finished it now.
I've been keeping up. I think maybe two episodes behind, which for me, keeping up, I have to watch most of my television independent of my wife because I binge television on like weird days where it doesn't matter. I have my shows that I watch and then, you know, we have we shows. But I'm keeping up with it. And my kind of bitch about it is that it's not in... It's in too high of definition.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about with John.
Right. Like I watched Saving Private Ryan last week. And that I think they shot it in all 35 millimeter. I could be wrong, but
sounds right.
In that like gritty pre-digital proliferation age where you get like dirty imagery. You can like actually see grit on the film that was being used to capture the imagery. There's something really compelling about that and really immersing in that when you're watching these historic war films. You know, and I think like the John Wayne spaghetti westerns, where they cut in actual footage of people landing on beaches in the Pacific and getting killed, which is horrifying. And that never should have been done, but that's what they did because that's what they had. And it was easier to just use war footage than it was to hire extras and do something shitty. That's a whole other thing. But that gritty kind of dirty imagery, it matters when you're trying to be immersed in film. So that's been my struggle with Masters of the Air. But I got this tile on Apple TV that recommended to me a doc called The Bloody Hundredth, which is the documentary of the people who would then subsequently inspired Masters of the Air. So if you were to imagine watching Band of Brothers and then its companion piece of all the interviews with some cut-in imagery as opposed to, you know, 4 minutes of interviews ahead of and following the episode, that's kind of what the documentary was. It was all of the source material that then led to the production of this show. And it was so good. You have Tom Hanks narrating, you have interviews like cuts in from Steven Spielberg, like the ass behind the show telling the story kind of in companionship with the product, you know, being the television show. It was good. I like
I was second screening while I was watching it, and then I kept rewinding and ultimately put my phone down to watch the documentary.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a good, it's an hour and 2 minutes, so it's relatively short, but it's really good. And they've got the source material interviews with these people who were the, you know, the people who were then represented in the show. And it tells the story in a really different way. It's like when you see the character, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to go home. I'm going to stay here with my friends. And then when you see this old guy who was like, no, it seemed weird to go home when all my friends were still there. And, you know, I flew 25 missions, but you know, whatever, I had more in me.
Now, I will say both.
It's a little different.
Both you and John Lilly from Markwell said the same thing about the high definition cinematography. Mm-hmm. You had the opinion that it was off-putting. I didn't share that at the time, and having now finished the series, I don't share it now. It didn't bother me at all. In fact, I thought the cinematography was beautiful.
It is beautiful. It's too beautiful. It's not dirty enough.
Yeah, that didn't bother me.
When you see war, it's not clean.
I will say the story didn't suck me in as much as I would have hoped. And by the time I got to the end, I felt like I knew the characters a little bit better. And I was like, okay. But yeah.
It was Band of Brothers meets Pearl Harbor, which was kind of problematic.
With maybe just a less compelling story arc.
Yeah, because it met Pearl Harbor, right? They were like it was the cinematography, it was the big stuff. And when you watch things like Band of Brothers was real, and you have these story arcs, these characters who they really dive into. And Saving Private Ryan, not real, but they tell this really beautiful story with these characters who matter and you're curious about them. And it just didn't feel that way with Masters of the Air.
We did get one Great Escape reference at the POW camp, which I was like, oh man.
Which they do talk about.
The three tunnels. And I was like,
they do Tom talk about the dock, which was really fascinating. Because one of the guys there was like, yeah, these fucking Brits are like, they dug this tunnel and a bunch of them got out and then they killed a bunch and two got away and it ruined it for the rest of us. We're like, oh, you never really thought about that. And you watch The Great Escape with Steve McQueen. You're like, oh, he's a fucking awesome man. Like, oh, wait. That has consequences.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Oh, well, that's terrific. I'm going to check that out. What was it called?
It is called The Bloody Hundredth.
The Bloody Hundredth, okay.
Because that was the name of this group in the Army Air Corps, this bomber group who...
had to do all these missions.
Not more than necessarily other groups, but they just had really, they just had bad luck.
Yeah.
There was a couple bomber groups who were doing comparable amounts of flying and losing less crews and aircraft. And
yeah.
The Bloody Hundredth, because that's,
It is brutal. That's what I will say about Masters of the Air. It is really, really the story of a group of folks that had a rough time. And that's valuable in and of itself. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Andrew, I've got another thing.
Do me.
My other thing, I've got it in my hand.
Don't shiv me.
It's a knife.
Oh.
It's a knife.
Why are you holding that?
So in the true spirit of other things, I have acquired a piece of EDC gear. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
I just decided recently that I wanted a knife, and I wanted a fancy knife. I have been for the better part of 5 or 6 years at this point, daily carrying a case Sodbuster Junior knife.
Mm-hmm. This is a great blade.
We both have one. Matching knives. Mm-hmm. It's a yellow handled brass pin case Sodbuster Junior with a carbon steel blade. It's gorgeous at this point. Because that carbon steel just patinas really well. I've used the shit out of it.
It doesn't matter if you use it or not. It just patinas.
I've sharpened it, you know, at this point, 20 or 30 times. It is razor sharp all the time. Mm-hmm. It does all the things I want. It is a slip joint knife, which means it doesn't lock open. And that can present some problems depending on how you use it. By and large, if you know what you're doing, you're fine, right?
Yeah, just be a grown-up about it.
If you use it like a locking blade knife or if you're prying or twisting, there
you
could
will
be,
have some weird things.
You might have some repercussions, that's right. But I love that knife, and I think it's great. It is not, however, a fancy knife, and we're really at this point in knives where you can get the greatest knives ever made. I mean, that's probably always been true at any stage, but you just, I mean, there's just so many knives out there, right? Small brands, big brands, mm-hmm. everybody's making terrific knives.
Yeah, everybody.
Yeah, there's probably...
Gerber is making phenomenal knives for $35.
That's right.
The Fast Assist is one of my favorite EDC knives I've ever carried.
There's probably 24 Asian companies right now making really, really, really good, high-end, as good as anything knives. Civivi is one that comes up a lot. There's a number of brands. Anyway, much like watches, we're in a total like heyday for good knives. If you want a knife, you can get one for well under $100 that's going to be as good as anything that was made 5 or 6 years ago. Anyway, that's not my point, because I bought a knife from the most boring knife company, which is Benchmade.
Do you know why they're most boring?
Because
they do nothing fancy. You can make it fancy.
They do nothing fancy, but they also are just like, and they're overpriced, right? I mean, everybody agrees that Benchmade knives are probably slightly overpriced. So I decided not only was I going to buy an overpriced Benchmade, but I was also going to buy like a heavily specced out, like really overpriced Benchmade.
Yeah, so you went big on it.
I bought a watch that cost roughly $300. This is not a watch for the faint of heart.
It's a knife, not a watch.
But I love it. Okay, so what this is a Bug Out. A Bug Out is probably Benchmade's most popular knife.
It's the top three. It's the Bug Out, the Osborne, and the... there's a third. It's their three, like, these are our customizable knives, and it's those three.
And this one is a special Bug Out. Bug Out's kind of controversial because a lot of sort of enthusiasts don't like it. It's really a thin and a lightweight knife. It's not a knife. It's not like a bushcraft knife. Really, this is a knife that's meant to be heavily packable. They weigh like one point, the stock Bug Outs weigh like 1.8 ounces. It feels like paper in your hand.
Crooked River.
Oh, the Crooked River, yeah, sure.
The Bug Out, the Crooked River, and the Osborne are probably their three most popular blades.
I got one that comes OEM with carbon scales, and it's a true carbon fiber scale. It's got an S90V blade, which if you know anything about steels, this is a true super steel blade. It's basically just trick as fuck. I immediately field dressed it all the way down, sanded the phosphor brass washers with 1500 grit, and then polished them with Cape Cod cloth, and then put it all back together, oiled up to make the action just absolutely hot.
It's a little too hot. I have a laceration because I lost the thumb stud when I was opening the knife.
Yeah, it's pretty hot.
And found the heel of that blade. Like, whoo, got me. And Benchmade comes so sharp.
Yeah.
It's a
laser blade.
It doesn't matter how you treat your blade in the first year, you're never going to have to come near a stone.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know. I've obviously only had this. I told you earlier, I haven't really actually even used it. It's effectively for me.
We've only cut flesh with it.
That's right. That's right. It's effectively for me at this point, a fidget spinner with a really dangerous sharp edge on it.
Lessons got to be learned, man.
But I love it. Yeah. I just holding it in my hand, I love it. I'm so happy with this purchase.
So I've been in the market for a downgraded tactical knife, right?
You, you carry a Presidius, is that right?
Yeah, the Presidio, the Mel Presidio knife with that like dual like beveled grip, and it's heavy. It like the when I first put it in my pocket, I had to tighten my belt loop or tighten my belt one notch to like keep my pants from falling down because it's heavy. It's thick. It's all steel. It's a great tactical knife. And that's not a world that I live in anymore. But I still really want to have a appropriately sized knife. So I've kind of been in this, and I think this is the right size because I do also keep a case Sodbuster in my bag, but I want to have a knife a little bit more accessible than in my bag. And the Presidio is big.
Just a little too big.
It's too big. It's too thick. It's too heavy. This is the right size. And we were talking about it before the show. This is not big enough to be a big knife. Mm-hmm. Nor is it small enough to be a small knife, which maybe makes it perfect.
Or as discussed off also the air,
wrong.
Completely, yeah. It's not small. It's not big, and so it doesn't meet either thing. But it's a compromise in terms of size and shape. However,
I really like the shape. It's a flat spine mm-hmm. grip. And that's kind of my concern with the Osborne, is it's got a little bit more curve to it. And I am at, and the dimensions are virtually identical, but with that curved spine. And that curved spine in that size kind of causes some second thoughts for me.
Yeah, our daddy, Watch Clicker Will, is a 940 Osborne mm-hmm. and a mini Osborne carrier. So he's a big fan of both of those watches, both of those
knives.
Knaps.
Yeah.
This, you know, I decided.
Because he's all about that Osborne.
I decided to take a flyer on this, I'm so happy I did. It's just a terrific knife. I'm sure there's going to be people at home that are going to write to us and tell us about why I'm wrong.
And, you know, we also recognize that there are 100 other big brands and boutique brands out there. You know, we were talking about this knife and it led to us talking about, a dozen mm-hmm. other knife makers out there in similar price range. And we talked about everything from Spyderco to Half Face. We were talking like $35 to $1,000 blades. And what it comes down to is what you like, just like with watches. And it's also okay if what you like sucks.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be some people out there who are like, no, you got to buy Gerber. And, you know, Gerber makes some good blades. But you're not getting the same craftsmanship, the same quality of materials. And I've used a lot of Gerber blades.
Or maybe you are, right? I think the biggest competitor to the Bug Out is a knife called the Hogue Deca. Hogue mm-hmm. is also an American-made company. They make really high-end shit. You can get a Hogue Deca for like $100 to $150 less than this knife. And it is, by all accounts, every bit as good. You know, maybe not the carbon scales. And I think a lot of people are upgrading the scales on their
Decas. The non-carbon Bug Out, $180.
Yeah, that's right. And I think a Hogue Deca is like $150 or something like that. And so, you know, I spent, I think, $275 with my AD discount on this. And that's a lot of money, right?
It's not insignificant.
But at the end of the day, I didn't have to think about it. I'm not upgrading anything. It's got a great titanium spacer. It's got a DLC type, you know, blue DLC titanium accents, which kind of gives it some pop. It's mm-hmm. got scales that you'd never want to upgrade. And if you did want to upgrade them, you wouldn't buy this one. It's already pimped, mm-hmm. which is what a lot of people are going to do. A lot of people are going to buy the regular Grivery Bug Out and then pimp it, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to wind up spending
more,
and doing all this work. This is just out of the box, the knife that I was excited about. So yeah, there's always trade-offs, I think, is your point.
Our prime disagreement is that I want a combination blade and you want a
Boo. Straight blade.
I've had enough.
Andrew, anything you want to add before we get going for the day?
No, we should probably call it.
Well, can I just quickly thank the folks at home
for you must.
Tuning into this episode of 40 and 20, the Watch Clicker podcast. Hey, do me a favor. Why don't you go to our website? You can find that at https://www.watchclicker.
Just regular slash, /.
Watchclicker.com. Look, that's where we post articles every week. You should check it out. There's some cool stuff that went up this week. It's also where we post every single episode of this podcast. You can check us out on social media, really at Instagram, at WatchClicker or at 40and20_WatchClicker. And that's where we post updates about what we're doing on the website and here on the show. If you want to support us, and oh boy, we hope you do, you can do that at patreon.com/40and20. Look, everything we do costs money. Hosting pictures and hosting audio and software and hardware necessary to make those pictures and audio cost money. The folks that are supporting us make that happen. Thank you to everybody supporting us. Check us out, patreon.com/40and20. And don't forget to tune back in next Thursday for another hour of watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like.
Bye-bye.